Welcome to The Rink, a hockey podcast by hockey bloggers for hockey fans. I'm James Tapeleg Graylian, along with my co-host, Tom Luongo. This week, we're going to be talking with Dirk Hoge, also known as the Forechecker. He's going to be talking to us about the Nashville Predators. Well, it's Hockey Hall of Fame week, and there's some induction talk to be talked about. Darcy Tucker decided that it's time to live up to his expectations. And we're going to be talking about some of the new third jerseys that have come out. It's the good, the bad, and the ugly on the rink. Hockey Hall of Fame inductions are this week, and the four guys going in this year, it's hard to complain about any of them. Ray Scampanello, Igor Larionov, Glenn Anderson, and Ed Chenoweth. There's not a bad choice in the bunch, really.
Of course not. You've got two of the greatest players, I think, who ever donned a jersey, and Larionov is probably, I still think, one of the most creative centermen of all time. And then Glenn Anderson is the big-time goal scorer, playoff goal scorer that he was, and during the great years in Edmonton. But it's the other two guys. It's Ray Scampanello, whose big bald head, we watched fly up and down the ice and as a linesman for 30 years or something like that, and officiated more games than anybody else in I think history. And Ed Chenoweth is a longtime head of the Western Hockey League and Canadian Hockey League, and he's being honored posthumously because he died last year.
Yeah, I mean, Scampanello is my guy for this whole pick. I mean, I don't know if you've been able to read his book Between the Lines, but there's some great stories in there. And just a guy who, anytime you listen to him talk, all he wants to talk about is tell stories about hockey. And it really, he's one of those guys that proves that referees are as big of fans, if not bigger fans, of hockey than the people who, like you and I, who talk about it, who write about it, who watch it. You know, these guys got involved because they love the hockey. And then to read about them and hear the stories and just how much in awe they are of the players and the game, he's one of those guys that to me really solidifies my appreciation for how hard of a job the referees have and even the linesmen, who are just people think of as throwaway guys.
Oh, no, I don't think the linesmen are absolutely important in the ebb and flow of a hockey game. They're the guys who are asked to, keep emotions under control as much as anything else. They have the hardest job on the ice, which is to call offside. You're trying to figure out whether the puck and a guy skating to 30 miles, and they're both coming across the line to 30 miles or 40 miles an hour at times. Did it happen right? And, did the line changes happen the way they're supposed to? And all of that stuff. And there's, it's a terribly difficult job.
Well, if you ever have a chance, you have to read his book. He's got so many good stories in there, just from his perspective and being right there, between the guys, dropping the pucks, making the right calls, making the wrong calls sometimes, and having to deal with the aftermath of that. I mean, that's
right.
That's some of the accountability that these guys have. When we think about the accountability of these refs, they never seem accountable for when they make mistakes. Oh, there's somebody right there on the ice ready to tell them.
Oh yeah.
And especially if they did get it wrong.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then there's usually, and depending on the city you're in, there's anywhere from 12,000 to 18,000 people telling you that you were wrong as well, regardless of whether you were right. So yeah, it's in a lot of ways the thankless job. And I'll be the first one to start screaming at the referees when I'm at home watching a game and I don't like the way it's being called. But I do recognize that they have an extremely difficult job, even if I don't agree with how they're going about it. But who am I to talk?
Well, this group, who's tops on your list?
Oh, without a doubt, it's Igor Larionov. He's the only guy that I've got I went out and got a player jersey of because I wanted it, and I've got an old Russian, either I think it's from one of his Red Army jersey, the early days Red Army jersey, and it's in Russian. It's in Cyrillic. It's awesome. And to me, he's just – when I came back to watching hockey back in 1997, 1998, and he was playing for the Red Wings, I watched this man in awe just see the game. And I think watching Larionov for me helped reteach me this game, and that how well he saw the ice and how well he was able to distribute the puck and be where he needed to be. And he's the thinking man's – hockey player in so many ways. And just every time I think about Igor Larionov playing, I just get goosebumps. He just was that important to me. And it really hurt me when he finally had to retire. Mm. So.
Was it, I believe it was last year that they had that Larionov kind of had his farewell game in Russia and flew so many players over to be able to participate in. And it was just amazing to see so many players that respected the guy so much. I've never heard a bad story about Larionov at all.
Okay, so I'm looking at the article at NHL.com right now. So here's giving you an idea of what kind of person he was, right? So this from John McGurdy at NHL.com. So the Soviets were forced to deal with the NHL teams where they would send part of the player's salary to the Russian Hockey Federation as compensation, I guess, for the players jumping ship when he first came over. Larionov was so outraged by his former bosses skimming money from players they no longer wanted that he played out his three-year contract with the Vancouver Canucks and then went to play in Switzerland to stop the money flow. The upside of that, it allowed me to learn Italian, he said. That's just awesome. He's just the man.
Wow.
Yeah. He's like, nope, sorry. No. It's just cool. So he retired with 169 goals, 475 assists, 644 points in 921 games, and he didn't enter the NHL until he was 29.
Well, let's talk about Ed Chenoweth for a moment here. Longtime president of the WHL and the Canadian Hockey League. And, some people say that the Canadian Hockey League wouldn't be what it is today without him.
I would have to agree with that. This is one of the major figures of Canadian junior hockey, and those guys don't get a lot of press down here, especially south of the border at all. The junior leagues don't, but they're what we they're the life, they're the pipeline that we keep talking about all the time. Without them, we don't have a league, we don't have anything to talk about. And interesting legacy for him. Harry Neal brought it up over the weekend in one of the Buffalo games that actually two of his sons are GMs in the WHL.
Really?
Currently. Yeah.
Wow. He was president of the league for 20 years, in 1975 to 1995. Aside from just a stunning legacy, I mean, these are – when we talk about prospects and we talk about these teams and in all these places, these are just teams to us in a way. They're just places on paper that right. various prospects play in. But it's hard to get a sense of how much of a community is wrapped around these teams. You go up to the smaller Canadian towns that have these places that Americans look at and go, "Where the hell is that? That's kind of what the hell kind of name is that for a town and stuff like that?" But this is not just hockey; it's community building in a way. And you got to think that this guy, that Chenoweth knew that.
Yeah, I almost definitely, especially I'm a big fan of WHL defensemen, born and bred defensemen. I love those guys, and to know that this is in many ways the steward of a lot of great defensemen that have come out of the WHL, and even and a lot of forwards too, but certainly the very physical defensemen, the rough and tumble WHL. This is where your stay at home defensemen are built. And built and bred and born and I always hats off to these guys for providing that framework and that infrastructure for those kids to learn their craft so that we get to enjoy the great things that they're capable of doing when they become adults.
So the last guy we need to talk about is Glenn Anderson, and looking at his career, it's all about the numbers.
Yep. 93 playoff goals in 225 games, 5 overtime winners, and at the time he retired, ranked just behind Maurice Richard's 6. I mean, now your Joe Sakic has 8, but at the time, 5 overtime playoff goals was huge. Nearly a point per game player in the playoffs. He was clutch. He was the guy that classic elevated his game during the playoffs to a different level.
Absolutely the right guy on the right team at the right time with Toronto. It's just stunning. That kind of performance. When are we going to see that kind of performance again? I mean, he obviously had guys around him that could help him elevate his game too. That Edmonton Oilers era was all about teammates that made each other better.
Oh yeah, I mean, but you have to looking at those numbers. Remember that Glenn was their third centerman. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can argue that's how deep they were. You know, Gretzky, Messier, Anderson. You know, and they could just roll out line after line after line that wanted to and could score goals in waves.
Mm. And then, of course, he didn't stop there and went on with the Maple Leafs for a little bit. But, of course, the New York Rangers cup-winning year, and it's impressive. He's got some stuff.
That Rangers team in 94, when you go back and look at it, it was practically its own. You know, Mike Keenan was the coach, but, I mean, they practically had a coaching staff on the ice, you know, when you at that point with Messier and Anderson and all, you know, the young. It was such a deep team, and six Stanley Cups. It says it all. Hey, you know, I'm looking at looking at Dirk's vlog actually, and I'm seeing this third jersey thing here, and I have to say, the Buffalo jerseys are nice. I like the Oilers. Jerseys, the throwbacks, and the St. Louis third jerseys are kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like them. But they're only cycling four of them. They're cycling the Islanders, which I can't stand, the Oilers, which are very classic, and the St. Louis ones are kind of nice, and who's else in the Thrashers? I don't care about that. They're red at the very least, not that stupid color, not that periwinkle blue, which is just horrible.
Penguins have theirs. Which is the new?
What's that?
The Penguins have a third jersey this year, which is pretty much the Winter Classic jersey, but now as a Reebok Edge jersey.
Right. They're just cycling these four through, and I was like, wow, those are mostly really good. I the St. Louis one is very similar in style to the Pittsburgh one, in that it's that circular crest with the name around the outside and the logo in the middle, and similar to the Pittsburgh logo on a dark blue jersey with some yellow piping on it. It's kind of simple and direct. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, the Thrashers one I am not pleased with. Well, not that they asked me. They should be asking me, but...
The Thrashers haven't had a really good... They had a great original white jersey. I thought their original white jerseys were outstanding. I never liked their colored jerseys at all. I never liked the original, what it would now be the home jersey. I always liked the original, that original Thrasher logo on the white background with the piping. I thought that was nice. I thought that looked good. And the color scheme was nice and all of that. But
and now you want to buy.
No, I do like the Buffalo third jersey a lot. I would hope that when they decide to finally, when they decide to ditch the slug, that they go to that. I would be extremely pleased. I'm not buying. I'm not buying a sweater anytime soon. I can tell you that right now. Oh, sorry. These are jerseys. These are not sweaters.
These are not sweaters. Right. I every time I look at one of these things and I go, oh, maybe I get near one and I can't do it. I just.
Yeah.
Cannot stand the new jersey. They do, the Reebok Edge just feels cheap. It wears cheap. It wears poorly. I just, you know, the only people who look good in these things are the players when they're wearing pads, and they look like Rock'em Sock'em robots.
Right.
I just don't like them. I don't like them at all.
Yeah. Fair enough. You do run a blog called Jerseys and Hockey Love, so you know, one would expect you to have extremely strong opinions on such a subject.
I feel moderately about that. No, I hate the things. I fake stitching and patches that aren't real patches and what a how much of a price bump? A $40 price bump? $30 price bump? Oh, yeah, please!
Same.
I hate these things, and I wear a hockey jersey almost every day throughout the season.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a hockey jersey nut, and I hate these things.
Oh, that's got to kill you.
I put one of these things on. I tried on a Washington Capitals jersey just to see it. As soon as I put it on, I just knew I wasn't going to spend any money on it. And I don't see many In Colorado, I don't see a lot of them compared to the previous jerseys, the previous style of jerseys. Unfortunately, I saw a Darcy Tucker jersey. Somebody actually spent money on not only a bad jersey, but on a Darcy Tucker jersey.
That just pains me.
I wanted to take that jersey off of them and tell them, no, never again. No. If you want to spend $100-something on that jersey, you can give it to me and I will buy a good jersey. But no.
You could go on eBay and at least get one from when he was with the Leafs. It would be made out of the right material in the right cut and all of that. And then you could wear that around if you want to, you know, if you want to show your Darcy Tucker love, do it that way.
Well, and I'm not having any love for Darcy Tucker right now. Darcy Tucker got a clipping penalty, which is a penalty that was essentially written just for him when he took out Michael Pekka in 2002. He is supposedly a little here's the background, and this is what incensed me, that in the November 6th game, Avalanche versus Minnesota Wild, supposedly he threatened a player to take out his knees and then tried to take out his knees. And if that isn't intent to injure, I don't know what is. And to me, this is the worst kind of behavior you'd find in the NHL at all. There is absolutely no respect for other people, for other players on the ice, and the excuse given is I'm playing 100%. This makes no sense to me.
Yes, I'm almost speechless because I'm still shocked that the guy has a place in this league, and he's been given nothing but good pricing signals by Clown Shoes Campbell, who did not suspend him. Again, somehow saying that it was a good hockey hit, and me and Colin Campbell do not see eye to eye about what is and what is not good hockey hit. And he's a clown. He has always been, and he's a dangerous player, and he's a dangerous person to have in, I think, to have in your locker room and to have skating on your team on the ice, and not just for himself, but for everybody else around him.
I have to agree with you. The thing is that these GMs and keep giving him contracts, and that's what that to me, even beyond, you know, Colin Campbell can suspend as much as he wants, but when you still have a contract in your hand, that right there is condoning the actions. And until the GMs actually wisen up a little bit, or that the culture of the NHL has changed away from this, every contract is going to allow these guys to do more and more. They can legislate, they can punch each other, they can do anything that they want, but until they stop giving these guys contracts, it's going to keep happening.
I'm not disagreeing with you, and it gets back to, again, I keep coming back to, you know, what I proposed a few weeks ago and what I've been thinking about for a long time about this, about real solution to the problem and putting the Avalanche in a tough position relative to him in the future playing against Minnesota or somebody else, and allowing Minnesota to somehow get the right, you know, the right fit of restitution for this action. That's the only way you're going to put a cold towel on ever giving him another contract, if you understand what I mean.
And
I think that's the only mechanism that I can come up with. I mean, if someone can come up with a better mechanism, I'm all ears. But the best that I've come up with so far is this kind of arbitrated restitution thing, where the team is, you know, let's be realistic here. If the next time Minnesota and Colorado play, and you know, Colorado's not allowed to put Paul Snazdy on the ice because of something that Darcy Tucker did in the previous game.
Yeah.
And they lose, and it costs them a playoff spot. I wonder if Darcy Tucker's still going to have a job.
Here's the wicked pisser about it, too, as an Avalanche fan, is that two nights later, he scored the only goal in the Avalanche's only shutout win of the season and stopped a 5-game losing streak.
Right.
Now it's possible that somebody else would have scored the goal if it hadn't been him. But that's a crappy position as a fan to be put in. I don't want the guy on the team. and then he stops the losing streak.
Right.
Damn it.
And guy, having guys on your team like that are a nothing but a big bag of mixed emotions. We were talking about Patty Coletta earlier with Dirk Hogue, the forechecker who we're interviewing soon. And every time Patty gets on the ice, I have butterflies in my stomach that he's not going to do something stupid. Mm-hmm. He's not going to hurt somebody because he plays on that edge. And I hope that he, you know, as he goes through his career, that he never morphs into the guy that Darcy Tucker's really become. Mm-hmm. And I hope for it because I think he's a good kid. But, you know, you never know. And I think in the hands, he's got to be handled properly in the hands of the right person while he's growing up. Tucker was given free rein when he played for Pat Quinn. And that was his M.O. Mm-hmm. Go out there and hurt people. Well, let me kid you, because Pat Quinn kept putting them on the ice. And Pat Quinn can, you know, argue with me saying this right now, but Pat Quinn, you kept putting them on the ice, and he kept hurting people.
You know, unfortunately, the Avalanche, for me, they started this whole trend when they got Brad May in. And Brad May was involved, at least in the mouthing off level, I guess you could say, in the Steve Moore incident. To me, that was just one of the most ridiculous backhanded slaps to the face to the Avalanche fans. And that it totally missed the mark with how the fans see their team. Right. Then again, maybe what it really is how the GMs and how the hockey professionals see the league. You know, are we now, instead of looking at the identity that we used to have with, let's say, Phil Esposito when he associated himself with Boston, and then he got traded to his absolute hated rivals, or that, you know, Gordie Howe is always associated with the Red Wings. Now our players just completely associate with the NHL and nothing more.
Mm. I don't know. I mean, I hope that's not what I'm getting at. I think the buried in your point originally was that maybe the GMs feel that they need to have. It's obvious they feel they need to have players like this around, because of that, without them they can't win. But at the same time, I don't think that's absolutely necessary that you give them free reign. Mm-hmm. And my problem here is, you know, a guy like Darcy Tucker, when you actually force him to sit down and play hockey, is a pretty good hockey player. And when you give him a system and you change his ice time based on his performance on the ice that doesn't involve knee doctoring people, I think he's a pretty effective hockey player. I've seen enough Darcy Tucker while in his years in Toronto, especially with the unbalanced schedule. I know the guy's MO left and right, and the easiest way to get him, you know, to back off is, you know, to force the Leafs to play hockey and not run around and hit people. Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously by winning. Or by beating them on the scoreboard, and then they can't really, you know, run around, and you got to keep the game close and effectively, you know, just beat them on the scoreboard, and that usually shuts them up. And if they can't catch you, they can't hit you. So, but I mean, he took out Tim Connolly's knee a few years ago. Same thing, you know, he went right after his knee and his hip. Same kind of thing. No suspension, no penalty on the play, for Christ's sake. Mm-hmm. Nothing. You know, it's been, we've seen it for years, and I hope that maybe there's going to be, you know, someone will finally wake up and just not hire him again, and that would be nice.
This week, Tom and I are talking to Dirk Hogue, but he's better known as the Forechecker from his blog On the Forecheck. Dirk is a Nashville Predators fan. That's a team I don't know nearly enough about. And what's the Predators record right now? Is it 6-7-1, or is that
6-7-1?
6-7-1. Okay, not awful yet.
Yeah, not awful. I think it's the character of some of the losses that really has people distressed.
Yeah. Well, the Nashville Predators seem like they're kind of off the radar right now. I don't hear much about them at all.
Yeah, and given the fact that they've like I said, kind of gone on the road and dropped a few in just different fashions. They lost 4-0 in Vancouver. Then they go into Calgary and just had a wild game last Thursday. Ended up being 7-6, but since it was so late at night, I'm sure a lot of folks in the Eastern, you know, times probably didn't even know what happened. You know, they just see in the box scores the next day. But they seem to have found every different way to win or lose a hockey game so far.
So we were talking about the Calgary Flames and their 7-6. Their 7-6 was it? That was a loss, was it not?
Yeah, it was. The Flames got out to a 5-0 lead. I think it was early in the second period, And it was funny because that evening I decided to just jump in on a live blog that was going on over at Five Hole Fanatics. You know, it was a Calgary, great Calgary blog. And, of course, by the time it was 5-0, they're whooping, they're celebrating, they're having a great time. And, you know, I was just puking in my lap. But I did tell them, I said, you know, even though it looks like a blowout here, these guys, at least they don't give up. They're wild, they're inconsistent, but they usually don't give up on Barry Trotz. And sure enough, they came back and made a game of it. It was they brought themselves within one with about 20 seconds left. They got possession of that final faceoff at center ice. They actually put a couple pucks on net in the final second. So I'm sure they had folks in Calgary pretty nervous.
At a 7-6 game, I would be too. It seems like we're seeing more and more of those. And I don't think that we can complain about scoring being down at this point with games like that.
Really, the pace of the game early on here in the season has been very much up and down, and more exciting than even in the last couple of years. And I just wonder, is it a case of the game really changing? You know, for instance, are they calling more penalties to give more power plays each way? Or, you know, perhaps are we even seeing teams not necessarily having things buckled down all the way coming out of preseason, such that things are a little looser in the defensive zone than most coaches would like? That's at least the appearance I get in watching these Predators. It seems like there's a lot of just basic discipline errors that allow guys to get loose in the defensive end.
Now, you were how are the fans in Nashville actually responding? From what you've been putting on your blog, that actually attendance is up a little bit from last year.
Yeah, it's up marginally, which given the state of the economy these days, you have to be happy with. Obviously, compared to places like, you know, Toronto and stuff like that, it's they look at it as pretty darn meager. The way attendance works here in Nashville, during football season, crowds are going to be pretty sparse. That's just the fact of the market. It's usually in January, February, that's when things really start to pick up, and in the stretch drive towards the end of the season. I think last year down the stretch they sold out probably the majority of the games in the last couple months of the season, but it's just these early months, they just have challenges there. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I noticed heading into this year, for instance, Nashville's the only team that doesn't play a Wednesday night game at home. And the reason that is because this is a strong, you know, church-going community, and Wednesday night's church night for a lot of folks. And so you have a hard time getting a good crowd to come out. Mm. You look at places like Chicago, I think, you know, they've got over a dozen Wednesday home games. So they've just done a little better job this year, I think, catering the schedule to the market. And I think they're up about 500 in terms of paid attendance per game, which is definitely a nice start. Not as far as they want to get, obviously, but not
even near, I would think, at this point. The attendance issues, of course, are going back now to the change in ownership and the way, in what looks to me like the team was structuring around what the ownership was doing. For instance, the trade of Volkoon and the like. Do you see that the Predators are starting to stabilize somewhat in with the ownership stabilizing?
Oh, I think so. I think since they came on board midway through last year, this is really their first full season to put their plan in action. Yeah, and again, based on the figures so far, you can definitely see some marginal improvement there. One huge difference between this group and the previous ownership, it just seems like they have a much greater sense of the local community and how to tie in with local employment groups, social groups, etc., and really make a pitch that, particularly with corporations, that tickets can be a tool that's used in business for positive ends. It's not just, you know, a status symbol to, you know, say you've got tickets and bring clients to the game, but it can be things like employee recognition or team building events. They've done a lot of that kind of groundwork, going out and selling the Predators in the business community. One interesting thing they've also launched recently is they call it the Ambassadors Club, and that's something where they're engaging their season ticket holders to act as kind of grassroots marketers for the team, and they can then share in some of those benefits. So, for instance, if you're a season ticket holder and you, you know, do the groundwork to help sell some tickets, they will then give you a credit towards your own ticket account. So you can use that to pay for, you know, playoff tickets or next season's season tickets or what have you. But again, kind of getting down to the grassroots level and really getting a deeper involvement with the community. The previous ownership, it was more of a kind of a top down. We're going to put it out here and pretty much demand that people show up, and if they don't, Craig Leopold kind of developed a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth by kind of bad mouthing some of the corporations around town.
Yeah, that's my perception of that outside of Nashville, is that Leopold was not a particularly engaged owner, and that he had actually done a lot to alienate the local community. And this sounds very positive. It sounds very similar to, you know, what we've seen in some of the other good turnaround markets like Buffalo and Pittsburgh and a few other communities where they've really tried to, you know, to solidify, you know, flailing interest in the team during down years or during, you know, turbulent ownerships or whatever. And that's good to hear.
Yeah, and in a sense, they haven't had the big piece of good news, you know, in the last several months. You know, they didn't make a big splash in free agency. They didn't, you know, obviously they lost Alexander Radulov, and that was a big negative development. But they've got lots of small positive stories. You know, you look at all the restricted free agents that they were able to re-sign and hold on to long-term contracts. You know, look around the league and see how many teams have lost good players at that stage of their career and what it's done to them. You know, like the Buffalo Sabres lost a couple of great players in the last few years. You know, there are a number of other cases. Here in Nashville, it's less sexy to do that kind of thing, but they've held on to some really good players, and what we should see in the next 2 to 3 years is the maturation of that group into a strong competitive team.
Well, Dirk, thank you so much for joining us. We're absolutely going to talk to you again later on in the season and find out how the Predators are doing then. So thank
absolutely.
You so much for doing this with us.
It was my pleasure.
I feel kind of bad because I barely let Tom get a word in edgewise with the forechecker, but you can hear the rest of our interview with him, and Tom has a lot more to say, on episode 7.5. That'll be coming out later in the week. For now, though, Tom leaves us with this quote from Igor Larionov.
In the Soviet system, we played five-man units, and they remained together for years. The KLM line lasted 8 years. When I came here, I learned that lines might last only a game or two games. You have to adjust your style of play and not be complaining about who is your line mate, and just do your best for your team.
Well, that's all the time we have this week on The Rink. Our thanks to Dirk Hoge, also known as The Forechecker, and his blog On The Forecheck can be found as part of the Kukla's Corner group of blogs. That's at www.kuklascorner.com. That's Kukla's Corner, spelled with K's. You can find The Rink at www.rinkpodcast.com. Tom's work is at nhl.fanhouse.com, and you can find my blog at jerseysandhockeylove.com. You can email us at rink@rinkpodcast.com, or you can call us at 845-704-RINK. That's 845-704-7465. And as always, we'll see you next week at The Rink.